One of the greatest positive changes in society, morally, is the worldwide recognition that people have rights. The right to water, the right to food, the right to education, the right to security. And we have organisations like the United Nations whose task it is to secure them for those people who are most at risk and most vulnerable. It's one of the most significant changes because if you'd have asked someone 100 years ago about human rights, they wouldn't have had a clue what you were talking about. Of course, rights can also be abused. And one of the most challenging things of our society in our day is that this, as people have become increasingly aware of their own rights, they are also increasingly willing to claim those rights, even if it is to the detriment of other people or society as a whole. I wonder if there are any circumstances under which you would be prepared to forego your rights for the sake of others or for a greater cause. Well, today we're considering a passage in which Paul speaks of giving up the rights that are absolutely due to him as an apostle in order that he can be more effective in the task that God has called him to in service for God. We're, of course, continuing our studies in the book of 1 Corinthians. This letter that Paul has written to this young church at Corinth, that he has established himself just a few years earlier. And it's a young church, and inevitably, therefore, they are struggling. They're struggling with how to work out this new faith that they've been introduced to. A faith which calls for Christians to live a radically different life from the lifestyle that they were used to previously. And in the first six chapters of the book, he'd had to admonish them for some of their behaviour, which was frankly appalling in all sorts of respects. But from chapter 7 onwards, we see that he starts to respond to questions that they have asked themselves, specific issues that they have, they've written to him in a letter all about. Now, last week, we started to look at the question of, is it right to eat food sacrificed to idols? And one of the things that we recognized last week is, whilst you might think that's a simple yes or no answer, can answer that in one sentence, that actually Paul takes three chapters of the Bible, three sections of this letter to answer that apparently simple question. Such was the complexity. Well, this week, in chapter 9, we're looking at Paul dealing with the second chapter. It's the middle of these three installments on food sacrificed to idols. So a question you should probably be asking yourself right now is, what on earth does food being sacrificed to idols have to do with Paul's rights as an apostle? I shall explain. In their letter to Paul, some of the Christians at Corinth had been stressing that they felt they had a right to eat food that had been sacrificed to idols. They could eat whatever they liked. That was their right. And this was because for them, as confident, maturing, assertive Christians, they were prepared to say, look, a side of beef is a side of beef. It's just food. Frankly, it doesn't matter what's happened to it before it arrives on our plate. God will treat it as just the protein and food and so on, nutrients that we need. We don't need to be worried about it. It doesn't matter to God what's happened to it previously. And of course, they were correct. It was their right to eat this food. But here's the point that Paul made. Knowing your rights is only the first half of the story. Knowing when it may be appropriate not to exercise that right is the other half of the story, particularly when it means that the other party is going to benefit. So, chapter 9, Paul is going to illustrate this point by going deeper into it. And he's going to illustrate it by using his own rights as an apostle and how he's choosing not to take up those rights. He's going to lead by example, and he's going to encourage them to consider giving up their rights to eat this food in certain circumstances, just as he is doing, for the sake of others. He's teaching them servanthood. That's what this passage is about. Now, before he can get to that, before he can get them to even consider his rights as an apostle, he's got another problem. And that is that as part of the letter, it's become clear that some people in Corinth are challenging his right even to call himself an apostle. So he's got to deal with this authority issue as well. He shouldn't need to do this. This is astonishing that they're questioning it. It was so obvious. The wider church in Jerusalem would have been appalled that the apostle Paul was having to defend his right to call himself an apostle. So his comments in answering that first bit are somewhat rhetorical. I use that word a lot because that's what this you see again and again in this chapter. You know what I mean by rhetorical? He deals with questions. He presents questions where we don't need to give an answer because we know what the answer is. It's so blatantly obvious. And he's kind of doing this, and he does it throughout the passage. He's sort of teasing them. Yeah. He's sort of saying, come on, engage brain. This is child's play. Understand this. See what the obvious is. So what is the evidence that he talks about? Well, he uses a few things. First of all, that he was free. He calls himself free. I'm an apostle. Some Christians clearly came under the authority and worked under the authority of apostles. Paul works only under the authority of Christ, and they understood that. It was recognized that that was Paul's authority as an apostle. More importantly, he has seen Jesus himself. Christians at Corinth had seen some amazing experiences, but they hadn't had this experience. Paul has seen Jesus for himself. And in chapter 15, towards the end of this book, he testifies to all those who had seen the risen Jesus for themselves. And Paul's name was the last on the list. That was this road to Damascus conversion experience that we're probably all very familiar with. And it was in that experience that Paul was appointed and sent out by Jesus himself. And if you want to see what Paul says about that, you can either read about the incident itself or look at Acts 26, verse 17, where you see Jesus sending him out. And of course, that incident was heard by witnesses. So here's now Paul, able to speak the good news firsthand that Jesus has risen from the dead. That's the role of an apostle. But there's one other piece of information that he gives, one other bit of evidence to support his authority. And that is this, that even if others doubted his authority, surely the Corinthians themselves should know better. Because they themselves are the proof of Paul's apostolic credentials. They'd come to know the good news because it was Paul who'd come and preached it. If you like, he was the seal. That's what the passage says, the seal of his apostleship. We don't use seals very much today, but they used to be used routinely. Routinely to guarantee quality, authenticity, in a whole series of products, from a letter that was being sent, from documents being transferred from one place to another, even from a bottle of wine to show it's the genuine article. So they would pour molten hot wax onto whatever the product was, and then into that they would press that wooden seal, that stamp. And it would create a unique imprint that would speak of the authenticity of the product itself. The change that had taken place in the lives of the Corinthians since Paul had preached to them was that unique imprint that demonstrated that was the seal of his apostleship. So there we go. That's the first part. He's demonstrated that he was an apostle. But having confirmed his credentials, he then has to remind them that surely he should then be afforded certain rights as an apostle. And he sets it all out in rhetorical questions. He invites them to recognize this entitlement for themselves. So he says, surely he should have the rights that other apostles enjoy, the right to take a wife, a believing wife, along with him on the journey, as Peter had. The right to have food, water, and the like provided for his practical needs, as others have, including Jesus' own brothers, including James, who would become a major leader in the church at Jerusalem. Surely they're going to agree that, like all of them, Paul should also have those rights. Just think of the task that he was about. This demanding task of preaching the gospel. And in Paul's case, he's doing it in entirely new circumstances all over the Roman Empire. You can imagine what he's going through, the hardships, the dangers. Surely they are deserving of practical and family support as these others have had. And then he drops in this little final question. Or is it only Paul and Barnabas who are expected to also work for a living, to fulfill that role whilst at the same time providing for their needs? And I have no doubt that they would know full well that Paul and Barnabas were renowned for their tent-making skills. They used them to make a living. And he then goes on and he gives three examples from ordinary life of people who wouldn't expect to provide for themselves. So he speaks about a soldier, speaks about the vineyard owner, he speaks about the shepherd. None of them would be expected to work at their own expense. Or at least in the case of those who worked on the land producing food or whatever it was, they would be able to partake, to benefit of what they had produced. And then he throws one final thing in, and it's a reference to the Old Testament, in which God's concern even for animals and their well-being is such that the Levitical law stated if an ox was treading grain, as it was referred to, if it was literally pulling a threshing sledge over the top of the grain to release the kernels, then the ox should not be muzzled. It should be allowed to benefit from the job that it is doing. And Paul's saying, if that's what you do for an animal, if that's God's compassion for them, surely it's right that God's people who are working in this ministry should also be provided for. Good argument. Can't really disagree. Should an apostle not likewise benefit from the spiritual seed that they have sown? So he's made two arguments. He's proven two points. He is an apostle and he has the right to support. After making these points so effectively, I'm positive that those who were reading this for the first time, those who were listening, were expecting in what was coming next. They just knew what he was about to say. So come on, lads. Come on, folks. Time to put your hand in your pocket and help us out a little bit. You can just waiting for them, waiting. He's going to say any minute now, he's just going to get into what he wants. Isn't it astonishing, therefore, that in verses 12 to 18, he does exactly the opposite. And he uses the next section to explain why, though all of what he's just said is true, he is going to choose to refuse to accept or exercise those rights as an apostle. As important as those rights are, for Paul, there's something that is far more valuable, and that is to further the gospel of Christ. And he wants to do that without anything hindering him. This is the calling that God has given to him. It's what God's called him to do. And he knows the importance of it. Do you know, I suspect that above all the other apostles, Paul knows the significance of the radical change that meeting his God and Creator really means in his life. Above all of them, think about it. The Apostle Paul, before his conversion on that road to Damascus, he was the chief prosecutor of the early church. And he did it, we read, with venom, with hatred. He was passionate. His job was to hunt down and kill Christians. He was the one who was holding the coats of those people that stoned Stephen to death. You can imagine the smile of satisfaction on his face. That was his life. That's what he understood before Jesus met him on the road to Damascus and literally stopped him in his tracks. And as he stopped him in his tracks, in the process, he rescued him from the bitterness and the hatred that was driving that response. And he set him free. So Paul's response, the reason he's so desperate to get out there, is he doesn't want anything. He's not driven by financial or any other reward. He's driven solely by the desire that other people would know the transforming freedom that Christ brings. That's what he lives for. And he knows there's nothing else in life more important. It's a desperate desire that others should know the same release that he's known. And it's as though he says Paul has no choice in the matter. It is a compulsion. He's just got to do it. It's the difference between a job and a calling. You know, even today, there is a real danger in receiving a salary or, in the Baptist Union's case, a stipend as a minister. There's a real danger in it. And it's this, that with that financial payment, there often comes expectation. An expectation, even a sense of ownership of the person concerned. And this expectation can get in the way of the gospel work for which the person feels called by God into ministry. I don't know whether you realize the difference between some church situations and the way the Baptist operates with the stipend. But the stipend for a minister is not an amount of money to remunerate a certain number of hours worked. It's a common understanding that that's what it is. Even here, I'm pretty sure many of you would assume that's what it is. It isn't. Instead, it is supposed to be a sum of money that facilitates a minister not to have to take on secular work so that they are free to do what God has called them to do. It is a facilitating factor, a financial factor. Can I be frank? I really think this is sometimes an issue for us in the church, in the West generally. I'm not speaking just of this church, but in Western churches. There can be a sense that congregations can take ownership of what a minister does because they've had a contribution towards that. There can be a sense, inevitably, that they want a minister to come and to be this person for them to serve in the building that they take such pride in the setting, under circumstances that are appropriate for them, in a way that they feel is appropriate for them, to give, to be the person who is the manager, to be the person who's an administrator, who will make things run smoothly, who will be the carer, And all these other things, including teaching and so on. All of those things can be part of a calling. But I need to say to you, there's something else that is much bigger that has to be part of your calling as a minister. And that has to be that fundamentally it is to encourage, to lead people to be a church that preaches the gospel. That doesn't just create a building that's for us, but we preach the gospel. We share the message of Christ to a world around us that does not know who he is. That has to be our priority. Please let us never lose sight of the fundamental calling, which is the responsibility of God's people to reach out to preach the good news outside of what we actually know as being our church life. In this context, Paul probably says something that supports that in some capacity, as he's saying he wants to be free to preach the gospel. He's adamant he must be free to preach the gospel. But in his case, there's a greater purpose behind this. Remember, we've said all along in the book of 1 Corinthians, we have to look at the context. And there is something else going on in the background that calls Paul to want to do this with no financial ties whatsoever. If you were being here when we were looking at the first few books in this particular, first few chapters in this book, you may remember that there were a group of people around at this time, itinerant speakers. They would go from town to town, from village to village, speaking the wisdom of the age, sharing what they understood. In this culture, this idea of special knowledge and wisdom was so important. And there were people who were teaching philosophy and wisdom and expecting money in return for it. And then hopefully, if people wanted to have even more special information, then they could make an intimate arrangement to have a private session where more would be shared for more money. Paul wants to differentiate himself from such practices, because that's not the way the gospel works. It was free, and it was free to everybody, not just those who can afford it. So Paul is adamant, and he wants to surrender his rights for the sake of the gospel. He even uses this phrase, being a slave to everyone. Can you imagine? He's actually prepared, with his authority, the position he's in, the understanding and wisdom that he has, to be a slave for everyone. But that's the understanding of the servant in servanthood. This is an astonishing lesson on servanthood. And his key point is this, and it is as valid for us today as it was for the church in Corinth. And it's this: Christian freedom is not freedom to do as you like, but it is freedom from all the things that stop you being the person God has called you to be. Freedom for the service of God and the gospel. And notice, I did say gospel. I didn't say church or our church. It is for the gospel. It is crucial. We exist here in our building, in our part of Parsons Heath, for one primary purpose. There are other things that we do as well. It is right to come together and praise God. Of course it is. We worship God. But there's something more fundamental. Jesus did not say to his disciples just before he went back to heaven, now meet together regularly, have a good old time and enjoy the sing song. He didn't say that. He said, go into the world, make disciples. Do you realize that this building was planted here in the 1870s as a mission church? This is a mission hall for Colchester Baptist Church to reach out to a new area of Colchester. So any priority focus that we might have, which is less than proclaiming and reaching out with the gospel, runs the risk of being self-serving. Do you realize that even the work that we do within this place, as God's people, as individuals, can still be self-serving, however hard it is that we might work? We can still do it, kind of because we want some significance, we want the support or thank you from other people. I wonder, do we walk through the door and say, whatever I can do, I want to do it for the sake of the gospel? That's his incentive to reach out and share that message with those around us. And if we lose sight as a church of our primary calling, then we do so at our peril, but also to the spiritual well-being, to the detriment of the spiritual well-being of the community around us. I ask you the question, how willing are you to be inconvenienced or to surrender your rights for the sake of others? Do you know, Paul was willing to go through extreme discomfort and hardship in order to win people. Amongst that, he sought to be weak for those who are weak. What does that mean? Well, it means he was prepared to identify, to get alongside those who were weak. I can just imagine how they must have read this with incredulity. The people in Corinth, this church that was in a culture which emphasized the importance of superior knowledge, of status, of confidence, the pride of being able to make a rigorously demonstrated argument for whatever particular thought you had, and to do so legalistically. And Paul, to them, is saying he's willing to put all that aside, his own pride aside, in order to get alongside people that some of whom he might win for the Lord. He speaks of becoming like a Jew to win the Jews. And so he goes on. And what does that mean? Well, in food terms, I'm sure that means that when he was with the Jews, he was kosher. When he was with non-Jews, he was non-kosher. Because neither matters to God, but to those that you are seeking to reach out to, and especially the religious on either side, those aspects of behavior are really important. Paul's being sensitive. And perhaps the best demonstration I can give to you of his attitude was when Timothy was circumcised in Acts 16. He was circumcised. Let me read to you what it says. Paul wanted to take him, that's Timothy, along on the journey. So he circumcised him because of the Jews who lived in the area. Now, Paul knew that one of the great freedoms of the Christian was that circumcision was no longer necessary. And yet, he asks his colleague, Timothy, to go through this process for the sake of others. That is a sacrifice. Rather painful one on the part of Timothy, I suggest. But he didn't want anything to be a stumbling block. You know, the tragedy is that some people had been watching Paul, and they'd seen the way he'd been behaving, and they'd seen that he'd eaten a meal in one way with one group of people and eaten the meal differently, or refused to eat this certain meal with another group of people. And they'd seen this as dithering. They actually saw this as undermining his authority, because surely he couldn't make his mind up. How could he be an apostle? Isn't it astonishing that they saw that as inconsistency? They failed to see it as sensitivity. So Paul summarizes it by saying, I have become all things to all men. Some have suggested this is accommodation. In other words, he's softening his message. And in evangelistic terms, it's called accommodation. He's accommodating other people's views. He's softening his message depending on who he's with. I don't think Paul did anything of the kind. On the contrary, it was his behavior that changed. His concern for the sake of the changeless gospel is a willingness to change his behavior instead. I wonder what issues you have that you feel so strongly about. Oh, I'm almost scared to mention this, but I'm going to. Gay marriage, the big bee in the bonnet for so many people. Christian meets some other person. The subject comes up, well, I believe this is, and bang, the drum gets in there. Let's make the point. And the lack of gracious response comes out. And the person who listens to the Christian says, yet again, self-righteous, opinionated. Wow, do I want to be associated with these people? Part of understanding your rights and the freedoms and truth is having a sensitivity in how to express it. What Paul would probably have done is sat down with the very people who were celebrating gay marriage and sat down and had a meal with them and talked to them and say, by the way, actually, this is what I believe God says on this subject. Have I opened up a hornet's nest by even mentioning that? I could have mentioned so many other things. I think Sunday trading is probably going to be about to be another one that Christians are going to shoot themselves in the foot on. It is about us being willing, even though we know why we stand and what God says, to be sensitive and being willing to meet with people and listen to their terms instead of banging the drum and telling people how wrong they are and how evil they are. Get to know them, build the relationships. How willing are we, I wonder, to change our behavior, our practices, our social opportunities, to do those things that are not necessarily comfortable for us, to reach out to those for whom walking through those doors is no less alien than it would be for you to walk into the doors of a mosque, through the doors of a mosque, or to sit in a bookies. It's not something I've ever done. I wouldn't have a clue where you start and what you do. That's how strange it is. But are you prepared? Are we prepared as God's people to think, Lord, where would you have us go? What would you have us do? How can I change my behavior? When you go on and you read the rest of that passage, and I'm not going to go into that, they're verses that you're perhaps a bit more familiar with. Paul speaking about disciplining his body, working, running the race. It is always in the context of what he can do in order to preach the gospel. He's not talking about what hardships he can do to paint the outside of a building or whatever else he might go through to help for the sake of the church. It's always for the sake of the gospel. It is about taking on board, not saying I'm tired and I need a lie-in and I can't make it this morning. It's actually about saying I will do what it takes on my knees prayerfully, as I would hope we would be as a church. Every time we have a mission opportunity like Messy Church, to say, Lord, what can I do for you? Beating his body, running the race, because the objective of the race is to win. And it's not to win us, for us, ourselves, it is to win people for Christ. What a challenge. What God has done for us. What sacrifices he has made for us. That's what Jesus has done. What are we prepared to do? Or do we want to preach the gospel on our terms? Because one day we're going to meet with the Lord. And being able to say, no, Lord, I definitely remember sitting there in a congregation on that Christmas service when other people came and visited. I remember being there. I just don't think that's going to cut it. What are we about as God's people? I'm stunned by the example of Paul. I couldn't claim to come close. I don't know anybody that does. But that's the inspiration. That's the motivation. For the sake of the gospel, to be all things to all men.